Every year, once or twice or so. First time I came, gee, I think it was about 1980. Must have been 1980. 22 years ago or so. I wonder, where were you in 1980? Do you remember? Maybe even some of you were in your previous lifetime, perhaps. Some of you. Yeah. So, I like to come here to UDW because there's a lot of nice students here, I know, and thoughtful people, and spiritually minded people. That's nice. Just as a matter of interest, are any of you here for the first time today? First time, really? All right. Everybody else is sort of a little familiar with what goes on and the ideas behind it and so on. Okay, that's good. Well, we have quite a bit of time, don't we? It's only 10 to 1 and we've got about an hour or so. It's quite a bit of time to discuss a subject. It's really, you know, it's quite a subject actually, that life comes from life. It's not the sort of thing, in my experience at least, it's not really the type of thing which people, a lot of people would expect in a religious forum. Like, this is essentially what most people would think is some sort of religious forum. But now we're discussing, it's really a scientifically related subject. And, you know, this Krishna consciousness movement, an interesting thing about it, in general, is that our approach to the subject of, well, say, religion in general, Dharma, if you're from an Indian background, you'd be familiar with that word, the Vedic scriptures, meditation, yoga, things like the spiritual subject matters. Our approach is, in some respects, and some very important respects actually, is quite different, somewhat different at least, from what you'll get from many other institutions which people would assume, you know, as something like us at least. Our approach is really somewhat different. And, you know, interesting thing is that as a result, somehow or other, or as a result, I think it's probably as a result, we often attract a different type of person. Not always, but there's definitely one segment at least of the people who become attracted to Krishna consciousness, who really, it seems to me, are different in sort of like the orientation about life than your average person who gets involved in religion. Just as an example, I'll give you just a very clear example from today, from right now, like 10 or 15 minutes ago, I spoke to three of the students here. So that's the first one. Actually, he's not here. He had to go off to do something, but I know he's very involved in Krishna consciousness and has been for some years and chants 16 rounds a day on his prayer beads, his japa beads. So I asked him, so, what are you studying here? And what did he say? And this is true. This is just exactly what happened about 15 minutes ago. I asked him, so what are you studying here? He said, oh, chemical engineering. Then I spoke to, what's your name again? Gavesh. Gavesh. That's an interesting name. I don't know if you, any of you with at least Indian names have analyzed your names. Gavesh could be I think would easily lend itself to be interpreted that gava in Sanskrit means the cows generally, and ish or ish, isha, means like God or the master, the Lord. Gavish then could mean the Lord of the cows, or Krishna, in other words. It's a fact. Just like this name Gopal, I'm sure you've come across that. Go is like an inflected form of the root form, which is Gav, and it means cows, cow, and Pal means protector. So Krishna, when he's called Gopal, means he's the protector of the cows. Yeah. Anyway, that's sort of by the way. So I asked then, he was the second one, Gavesh, the lord of the cows, or maybe the servant of the lord of the cows. I asked him, so what are you studying here? And you know what he said? He said, chemical engineering. So that was two in a row. And then I asked, what's your name? Sorry? Premila. Okay. Well, that's also an interesting name. Ultimately, and it can be applied broadly, but ultimately it would mean a lover of God. So I asked her, Premila, so what are you studying? And you know what she said? Chemical engineering. So that's three out of three. Maybe that's a pass. So, and they're into it. How long have you been involved in Krishna consciousness? It's a lot, it's a while, I know. Anyway, some years, right? A number of years. That's interesting. So, it is just my experience, in fact. You know, I was here. Oh, I come here every year, so I forget when it was, but a few years ago. And we did some sort of special program that day. And at the end, we gave out some gifts or prizes or something, some books, to some of the students. I forget why, but some sort of prize-giving function or something like that. So then again, I was asking the students, I asked all of them, there's about 50 or 60 of them, they all came up one after the other. I give them a book and I asked quite a few of them what they did. And, well, take a guess what a lot of them were studying. If you guessed chemical engineering, you're right. Yeah, it's a fact. And I asked others, and you know, there were a few accountants, a few lawyers. I didn't meet any students of religion. Do they teach religion here? Science of religion or something? Do you get it here? Or, you know, even something like English literature, something like that. You know, the artsy side of life. We got all these loads of scientists, particularly chemical engineers somehow. Really, it's a fact. Loads of scientists and a smattering of lawyers and a few accountants. And that was kind of, you know, the theme at least, dominant theme. What are you studying? Chemical engineering. Oh, you're a chemistry lecturer. Well, that's not unrelated. And what are you studying? Do you mind me asking it? Oh, no. I mean, good. Okay. Really? Okay. Well, I won't take a poll to see how many people are doing chemical engineering. But it is interesting. And, you know, the fact is, I'll be really, like, frank, is that, you know, the way we try to present, not just we, but in our tradition, coming down really from long, long time ago, in our tradition, the way that our, you know, our leaders through the generations, going back, and I mean hundreds of years now, and even thousands of years perhaps, is the approach to the subject matter in terms of like the perspective or just how we would look on it to start off with, and then, you know, how it's taught and practiced, the approach in broad terms, from the beginning right through to coming, really coming to grips with it and becoming like qualified and fully qualified in the whole subject. It is, you know, in many ways it would lend itself to being seen as a kind of scientific type of approach, as opposed to, you know, like the, you know, we believe in type of approach. We believe in, and, you know, we hope for the best, but we won't find out till we die, and then if we're wrong, it's too late, or something like that. You know, that type of, which I think would be seen generally understood as being more like a sort of quote-unquote purely religious approach to the subject, you know, which is religious, the subject. Yeah. So therefore we have within our movement, we have actually a scientific wing. And when I say scientific wing, you know, they're not just people like me, look at me. You know, guess what? I'm a dropout from university. Not exactly dropout, I walked out. I just, I won't tell you that story, but I was studying. I'm in fact one of the artsy types. My main subject was philosophy, which has become a scientific subject, really. You know, nowadays, in many cases, it's more linked with psychology than what we would regard as pure philosophy of, you know, Plato or Socrates particularly. So, yeah, I was there. You know, I had an interesting experience. I was there. I went to a philosophy tutorial. And it was just me and this young lecturer type guy who thought he was kind of smart. So he asked me, can you prove to me that God exists? You know, at least logically in philosophical terms. So I was not a very religious person. Although I was educated from, my first year in school, I went to an Anglican school. And from the age of five, in fact from the day after I turned five, in New Zealand you start school at five, so I was in an Anglican school, and from then till when I got the equivalent of matric in New Zealand, when I just turned 17, we went to chapel. The school had a chapel. Same school from the year five, age of five through to 17. We went every day, Monday to Friday, would you believe it? And they even gave us classes every day. They called it divinity, and you know what? I thought it was a pain in the neck. So I was not really very religious. But when this lecturer asked me, okay, in the tutorial, all right, can you present arguments which at least logically establish or, you know, logically quite strongly infer that God is a reality, like in pragmatic terms? So I was not very religious, but still I had a sort of a sentiment for it. You know, I kind of accepted it, even though I wasn't interested in doing it. So I thought in my mind, I thought, yeah, sure, that's okay, I can do that. So I presented a few arguments. Unfortunately, I guess he'd done it before. So he sort of defeated the arguments, or if not defeated in the sense of like, you know, smashed them to the ground, at least he showed how they did not necessarily establish the point. You know, there were like major grey areas, at least, which, you know, and then I thought, gee whiz, really, but that's not so good. Because I accepted it, even though I wasn't that interested. So we went through, it was like half an hour of this grilling session. And by the time I walked out, I was quite frustrated with this guy. And, you know, I was thinking, well, you know, that was pretty unreasonable to argue so strongly against God, because, I mean, not that I'm into him, but at least I accept him fundamentally. So I was feeling kind of frustrated, and I walked out of the tutorial through Auckland University, New Zealand. This is April 1972. And as I was, well, I won't ask you where you were in April 1972, most of you at least. But I was feeling kind of frustrated that, you know, even though I'm not into it, but at least I accept it, you know, it's just part of life. You accept these things. And this guy, you know, arguing in this way and that way, being a smart aleck. So I was walking through the university, and as I did, I heard the sound. It was like someone was ringing little bells or something like that. Yeah. Unusual little sound. Or, you know, like chink, chink, chink. Something like what we heard earlier, but more, but fainter. Yeah, and a little distant. So I looked around to see, you know, what's going on over here. And maybe 20 meters or 25 meters away, I saw Srila Prabhupada, our spiritual master. Yeah. That's his picture on beneath Lord Ram and Sita and Hanuman there, just underneath those three pictures. So I saw Prabhupada, and you know, I was really struck. It was such a strong presence. Even though he wasn't really doing anything, he was just walking towards me, and there were some devotees who were playing the little cymbals, kartals we call them, and the drum, you know, very gently and sweetly, actually. It was really a nice sound. And I saw Prabhupada, and he looked really kind of noble. And after this, you know, not very noble philosophy lecture, you know, Prabhupada looked very, you know, I wouldn't say maybe divine, but at least very dignified and, you know, stately at least, walking with his head back, sort of looking down at the world. It was very interesting. And there were these young girls, your ages, you know, around 20 or early 20s or whatever, and they were dancing next to Prabhupada very rhythmically. It was very beautiful, actually, throwing rose petals under his feet. I'd never seen anyone being treated like that before. It was like very loving and very respectful at the same time. And this thought just entered my mind from somewhere. It's not that I, you know, like really developed that thought. Suddenly I just found this thought was there, that this must be like heaven. So that was the religious side. That was like a religious experience. But then I got into it, and this more analytical side became apparent, that is really not, certainly not like the type of religion that I was brought up on every day from the age of 5 to 17, at least Monday to Friday, which was very much, you know, the close your eyes, hope for the best, and believe in it type of approach, where, you know, Anyway, you just have to believe it because everyone else is. But in terms of tangibility and very much which is practical and objective, it was really short in the extreme. So this, in this Krishna consciousness movement, after some time, I found there is this scientific wing, and they are real scientists. They're not just like me, you know. That was my first year in university, and shortly afterward I thought, no, this is for the birds. Not that you're all birds, but it was just maybe a phase I was going through. It was the hippie era, and I was very, you know, being a philosopher, I was really, you know, questioning so much about so many things, and particularly, you know, the sort of the more institutionalized and you know, the system and things like that. I was really into questioning these things, but in, I thought, serious philosophical terms. But now then I came across these real scientists. You know, they're actually PhDs in things like mathematics from places like Harvard University. So it means they're real scientists. They're not, you know, like, with all due respect, don't tell the Christians I said this, but, you know, they have their own universities and people, their preachers go there and walk out with a PhD, you know. But I tell you, it really is for the birds. It's just a rubber stamp. There's no real substance to it. Yeah. But these were real scientists with real PhDs in things like mathematics, you know, chemistry, organic chemistry, and how about, you know, have you heard of quantum mechanics? It is like an, you could say, practically, an esoteric aspect of physics, something like that, probability theory. Oh boy. Yeah, these guys are sort of big eggheads, you could say. But at the same time, even though they're like first-class scientists in as objective a sense as anyone could demand, but it's being applied in a spiritual or ultimately religious context, in the sense of it is one aspect of our tradition's efforts, not just attempt, but efforts to take religion and spiritual life beyond this kind of airy-fairy type of realm of, you know, this just believe it type of realm, but to bring it to a level of objective practicality and, you know, objective verifiability. And we might think, well then, you know, religion, this can't be religion, this is something else. But no, it is actually religion, spiritual life religion, but when it is really understood properly, and when it is taken step by step in terms of the practices and, you know, advancing in it, making progress in your spiritual life, then it is really something which step by step you can see progress, definable and, you know, verifiable, describable progress, and ultimately it leads you to a perfectional stage of God realization. Now, realization, this is an interesting word. I don't know if any of you are into the English language, but, you know, it implies that you are now contacting the reality of something. Realization. That what was previously a concept or even a belief or something, you know, less than objectively tangible, You know, you could say a belief. It means that from that point, it comes to actual experience. And I mean, after all, in the field of religion in general, and I'm including Christianity and Islam and Hinduism with its many, many, you know, kind of quite different from each other in many cases, branches, including all of these, we do have the concept is there, isn't it? That actually we're dealing with something, or meant to be dealing with something, which is a reality. But, you know, we're in such a condition, such a position, that to us it's not a reality, but it's something we believe in. But really it's meant to become a reality, at least at some point. But, you know, who gets to that point? I don't think we see so many of them. Like I saw on CNN on the internet this morning, the Pope has made an official pronouncement, like his official statement, about this current child abuse phenomenon which they've uncovered in the Catholic Church. Are you familiar with these things? You read newspapers? Yeah. So anyway, in America, just over the last, I think it's been since February or so this year, there have been some, you know, ghastly revelations about child abuse by priests in the Catholic Church. So it's become a big thing. So a few days ago, all the American bishops and cardinals, all the top men in the Catholic Church in America, they all went to Rome and they met with the Pope, I think yesterday or the day before. And now the Pope has come out with a statement. So, you know, when people are on the platform of molesting children, then they're a little way from God realization, I think. But actually the process, these types of processes, like it says in the Bible, what is the gain for a man or a woman who gains the whole world? What is the profit for a man or a woman who gains the whole world but loses his eternal soul? I know you may not know much about Christianity, but this is a well-known verse in the Bible. In other words, there was someone who was kind of more advanced spiritually in terms of having some practical experience and knowing in more objective terms the value of such things, the soul, and having some type of realization, connection with God. And according to him, it's so valuable. The experience is just so remarkable that if you compare it with the experience of owning everything on this planet, and, you know, that's quite something. Being, you know, what to speak of Bill Gates, being like, you know, 1,000 times Bill Gates, having those types of resources. Imagine what you could do with that. You know, if you were an avid materialist and life meant that I must gratify my senses to the nth degree and beyond. But this person, from some platform of realization, is saying that what is the gain, what is the profit, what is the value if you get the whole world but lose the soul? Yeah. So the idea is actually to make some sort of step-by-step verifiable and objective type of progress. Not just to stand there and believe in things And, you know, you don't really know much at all. But it's just somehow or other, you know, like people tell us that they are doing in Hinduism, they're doing some sort of puja or prayer or whatnot because their parents did, or their grandparents or great-grandparents. But, you know, they wouldn't have the faintest or much idea what it's really about. So spiritual life, religious life, is not meant to be just like that, blind sort of dogma and believing and hoping for the best. But actually, really, it is intended by those who have given it, and even, like I mentioned in our tradition, those who have been presenting it, and not just in the last couple of hundred years when Western science as we know it, you know, along with chemical engineering, have become prominent sort of philosophies in life, but going back hundreds and thousands of years, that this is meant to be something pragmatic and real. And you're meant to get into it. And if you do get into it properly, then certain results will come. And then eventually, you know, when you reach the actual point of being totally qualified, then you become God realized, or in other words, you meet God face to face. Some people would think, oh yeah, right, meet God face to face, sounds like a good one. But no, seriously, it's meant to be like that. It is intended to be like that, and actually it can be like that. So now, in this regard, I mentioned our scientific wing. It's called the Bhaktivedanta Institute, and it's got quite a number of these highly qualified and really very intelligent people in different scientific fields. So, our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, he, back in 1973, he met the first of these, the first, like, you know, real full-scale scientist, PhD guy, who had become interested in Krishna consciousness. He was from India, from Manipur, in northeastern India. And he, I think, had just completed his PhD in organic chemistry. So Srila Prabhupada started discussing with him, and the subject was, what does life come from? Does life come from matter, or does it come from something else, or particularly, does life come from life? In other words, is there a phenomenon or a reality called life, which is actually the thing which is making all of us tick, and basically making all living entities and everything tick, but which is not being understood currently by modern day scientists. In fact, they're sort of off on the wrong, you know, going down the wrong avenue at quite a rate of speed, and really missing the point and getting further away from it. So Srila Prabhupada, in this book, some of you may have even seen it, it's actually called Life Comes from Life. Srila Prabhupada is discussing this subject, essentially, and, you know, related aspects, related subjects. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. I did chemistry and biology and things like that, and physics. And, you know, when they made us dissect dead mice, Hare Krishna, in our biology class, you know, I was only 15 or 16 or something. And, you know, one of the guys, one of my schoolmates, who was, you know, a bit of a sort of a macho sort of guy, he thought it would be cool to stroke the heart of this, you know, I mean, the poor little mouse. I mean, his rib cage was wide open, to, you know, what to speak of being dead. But he stroked the heart. And there was some, I guess, some sort of motor response, but that little mouse started kicking. Serious. Yeah. And of course everyone laughed, except me. You know, I didn't think it was very funny. I had a kind of different orientation even at that point. So then, you know, I hate to say it, I threw in the towel with science. And I went back to English and philosophy and French and history and stuff like that. So, you know, I can say a few things, and I will make a few points which have their roots in this book. But if you are, you know, a chemistry lecturer or chemical engineer student type or something like that, in all seriousness, I would strongly recommend and advise you, get a copy of this book and read it, because here there's a very intelligent scientist, the real thing, and, you know, a very advanced spiritual sort of scientist, so to speak. Yeah. And in fact, for that matter, Srila Prabhupada was from a scientific background. He was in the pharmaceutical business. He was a follower of Gandhi. He went to university, passed everything, but on the day that they gave out the degrees, because he was a follower of Gandhi, on principle he didn't go, because it was a British degree. So he never got his degree, but he passed. So they're discussing these subjects. What is life? Is it just a combination of chemicals? Well, here's the other chemical engineer who came in. Okay. So what is life? Is it a combination of chemicals? That if you combine, I mean, now let's be serious and practical. How many of you really think, seriously think, that if you combine, you know, suitable proportions, quantities of, you know, like sodium and hydrogen and, you know, whatever, the various elements, chemicals which make up our bodies. How many of you seriously think that if you take these raw chemicals, which our bodies are actually constituted of, in fact, that you will be able to produce a living body? I think the food has your interest now, isn't it? In a sense, it's like a higher subject matter, actually, the food. But now, you know, I was reading, in fact, let me just make note of the point here. I was reading from the book as we drove in. It says here, a recent, this is now that PhD fellow, and he's written the introduction. So he says, a recent exhibit at the Los Angeles Museum of Natural History displayed a number of flasks and beakers. Each contained one of the chemicals found in the human body. The caption explained that although these chemicals represented all the contents of a human body in correct weight and proportion, they could not be considered life. Nor could any amount of scientific manipulation bring them to life. So that's sort of, you know, I suggested there that maybe some of you thought you actually combine the various chemicals and produce life. But here they're saying that in this scientific institution that they are saying that you can't do that. So the fact is, and even many scientists will admit this quite openly, if not all, but No one has so far taken all these chemicals, X amount of oxygen, hydrogen, etc., etc., and combined them and made a living being. It hasn't happened yet. So the premise that life comes from matter has not been established yet. So you know what that makes it? It makes it a belief. Now they believe it staunchly, many of them, isn't it? You would probably know very well. Staunchly they believe it, that in the future we will do it. We will produce, if not a full-scale human being, at least an ant, for starters. How about a cell, you know, an amoeba, a unicellular living entity? How about that? Well, to date, you know, with the greatest of respect to the scientists, what degree do you have? Bachelor of Science, okay. With all due respect to the scientists, but so far, and they've tried, but they haven't done it. But they really think they're going to do it. It's just a question of time. But the fact is that they believe it. It's a belief. Yeah. In other words, it is not scientific, really. I'll give you an interesting example and experience I had, something which is discussed in this book, the so-called Big Bang Theory. You heard of that, right? The Big Bang. First of all, you know, anyway, there are different views on what was the original state before the bang. Maybe everything, like all of reality, was compressed into one point, you know, literally, that has no length or breadth, an actual point. And then that exploded and it went all over the place. And the end result was that we're now all sitting here in UDW. Or maybe there was just like a conglomeration of the different ingredients. And then there was a Big Bang. And the end result of the Big Bang was that we're sitting here today in UDW. I mean, very specifically, not that someone came along after the bang and did something, but very specifically, the actual consequence of the bang itself, with no other input, but just at the natural consequence of the actual bang, is that we're now sitting here in UDW. Well, you know, to us, that sounds like, you know, it sounds worse than Adam and Eve, again, with all due respect to the Christians, you know, a Christian myth, a Christian fairy tale. It sounds, you know, like something straight out of nowhere. It's just stupid, actually. So one day, I was in Chatsworth, we went to one of the schools there, and we did a program with the matric students. Because they're not on your level, but, you know, they're getting up there somewhere. So there was this one boy, and he was into the Big Bang. He thought there was a Big Bang, and the end result was that we were there talking together in Chatsworth, specifically from the bang, implicit in the bang itself. So I said, look, you know, it doesn't sound so scientific to me. Science means, the basic program is, you have a theory, you test it, you experiment, and then you take the result, you know, it's objective, and then that's it, because it's now become objective. So, yeah, and he agreed, yes, of course, that is like the foundational idea behind modern science. So I said, you know, this Big Bang Theory, it doesn't really conform with that. But it's taken so seriously, and this, particularly this boy, took it extremely seriously. So I said, look, you know, there have been many big bangs in history. like Hiroshima, if you know what that means, Nagasaki, and, you know, they've done many tests on atomic weapons, you know, what to speak of the Second World War and all these other clashes where thousands and maybe millions of Big Bangs occurred. Yeah. So now, out of any of those bangs, any of those explosions, like Hiroshima, very classic case, directly on human civilization. So, out of any of those bangs, like out of Hiroshima, as a result of the bang, did we see anything orderly and nice and intelligent and so on come out as a result? Actually, we didn't. This is very practical. Any of these big bangs, like, you know, it was before almost any of our times, but in the Second World War, when after the German Air Force was destroyed at the end, and then the Allies were just bombing Germany into the ground, they bombed some cities until there was literally not a building standing. And they said that all that happened was that when they dropped a bomb, the rubble bounced. But that was all. The cities were literally flat. So, after these happenings, has it ever happened that as a specific result of the bangs,